Good morning. Are there any questions? You're not doing your homework. Okay. At the end of yesterday's session, I claimed that we had solved that apparently there is some problem with conservation laws in quantum mechanics. And I want now to explain better why this looks like this. And I may also tell you what is our idea on how to solve it. But first of all, what is the problem? I raise, first of all, the question, is it possible that two systems collide or interact for a while, and the probability distribution of a conserved quantity of one system has changed, while the probability for the same conserved quantity for the other system did not change? And of course, in order to satisfy conservation law, the probability of the sum of that conserved quantity remained the same. So here's the formal question. Suppose I have just a collision between two systems. Is it possible that initially the two systems were not entangled and the probability for momentum of one, of particle one, was given by this function, and the probability for particle two momentum was given by this function? And I ask the question, is it possible there will be some collision between them, and after the collision, the probability for P1 final will be different from the probability of the initial one, but the probability final of the second momentum remains the same as this. So this is different from the initial probability, and this is equal to the initial probability. Do you think this is possible? And I, of course, assume that the probability, the initial probability of P1 plus P2 is equal to the final probability of P1 plus P2. So conservation law means that if two particles interact, they exchange momentum, but they never change the probability of the sum of the momentum, because that's the meaning of the conservation law. But under this condition, it is still possible that due to the collision, the probability distribution for particle one has changed, and the probability distribution of particle two has not changed. Is it possible?
Question.
Yes.
So it would be possible if you assume that your external potential is not.
What?
If your potential, if you have that external potential, and it's not symmetric under translations.
No, I assume that the collision is only due to interaction between the two systems, and that interaction is then under translation. It's okay. A potential which is a function of the relative distance. That's okay. Why. That's why.
An assumption about the Hamiltonian. Describes the interaction.
Yeah, have interaction invariant under rotation, under translation.
It's invariant.
The interaction between the two systems, if it's by potential, this potential is a function of the absolute distance between them, and therefore that means that sum of the momentum must be conserved in any direction. The interesting music. You want to dance? It's on this side.
It's too late. Yeah.
Beautiful music. Let's see who it was. Right. Okay, I think I will close my phone now. Pity, it was such a nice music, right? Okay, so I repeat the question. We have a collision between two particles that satisfies the condition that the total momentum is conserved. That means that the interaction indeed is invariant under translation. I assume that before the collision, the two particles were not entangled, so the probability for the sum is equal, the probability for any momentum P1 and P2 is just the product. I ask, is it possible in such a collision to end up with a situation that particle 1 has changed its probability distribution, but particle 2 remained with the same probability distribution, and it still be a product state, and therefore there will be no entanglement at the end, and I want to satisfy that condition, that the probability of the sum has not changed. Do you think it's possible?
I'm gonna bite.
Yeah?
Give it a guess for how to do it and people tell me why it doesn't work.
Say it again?
What if I just transfer the sum of the momentum to particle 1 and make the momentum of particle 0 at particle 2 0?
Say it again? Slowly. What?
So whatever the distribution over the sum of momenta looks like, let's divide up. The original guy has a distribution over the total momentum and a distribution over the difference in momenta. So now I just make the momentum of particle 1 at the final stage, the sum, the momentum of particle 2, the difference, and have those same distributions.
Yeah, but then the probability distribution for particle 2 must have changed also.
That's right.
But I'm saying, no, I want the probability for particle 2 not to change. Is it possible? Okay, let me show you again the magic of the module of variables. If I want to analyze the condition for the probability of the sum to be conserved, I look at the probability to get P1 plus P2 equal to some P0 is an integral of the probability of P1 prime times the probability of P0 minus P1 prime. That's for particle 1, that's distributed for particle 2. That integral over P prime gives you the probability to find that the sum is equal to P0, right? It's a convolution. So the sum, the condition for the sum, probability for the sum to be the same is choose any probability for this one, then go to the difference. So this convolution, if you go to the Fourier transform of the probability, then it becomes very simple. If I look at the average of e to the I P1 prime, P1 over P0, that average initially is the integral of the probability for P1 times e to the I P1 over P0 dP1. So I can analyze completely the probability by looking at all its always Fourier transform, right? If I know the Fourier transform of the probability, I know the probability itself. Now the nice thing about doing the Fourier transform is that conservation law is now very simple. If I look at the conservation law, it's simply a product. That thing has to be conserved. Because the Fourier transform of the sum is equal to the product of the Fourier transform of each one of them separately. Therefore, the statement is, if we want that the probability for particle 1 to change, while the probability for particle 2 not to change, we want that for particle 1, the average of each of the I, P1 over P0 initially is not equal to the average of each of the I, P1 over P0 finally. If that is the case, then I know that the probability distribution for particle 1 has changed because it's Fourier transform, right? On the other hand, I wanted the particle 2 did not change, therefore, I want for particle 2 that the average of e to the I P2 over P0 initial is equal to the average of e to the I P2 over P0 final. So is it possible, if these two things are consistent with the fact that the average of the sum, the Fourier transform of the sum, which is e to the I, p1 over p0, because it's a product state, so the average, I wanted the average of e to the I, p1 over p0, times the average of e to the I, p2 over p0, I want this average not to change, because that is the condition that the probability of the sum did not change. So is it possible that I know that product is left unchanged? This by itself has changed, and this by itself did not change.
Is the distribution's
in
the distribution's
Yeah, because
initial
I assume exactly this. I assume that initially the two of them were unentangled.
Yeah.
Finally, one of them did not change, so it's still unentangled with the other. So I assume that the that they are both initially and finally unentangled.
I missed a step, then it's not possible.
So how is it possible that the product of these two has to be the same? This one has changed, and this one has not changed, yes?
The second one is zero?
Exactly. So I must have arranged. So I must have, for this to happen, I must have the module, the average, of the modular momentum, or that of its for a range of range of values must be equal to zero.
For all p0. For all p0.
Yeah, for all, not for all. It's enough if I do it for finite range, then that will change for that finite range. Okay, that has to be a finite range. So now we see what's going on here. Because we started with the following problem. We had our KVP. And we had a photon that in this region here looks like it has a very high energy because it has very short wavelength. Although if we look at the whole box, we know that the photon has only superposition of very small energies. And then we say, if something comes in and either cut it here or open and let it go out, we'll suddenly see that the same photon that before had only low energies suddenly has a probability to be out, and that will be with high energy. And the question is, who is responsible for giving this energy? And now I'm trying to show to you that what's happening here is again this magic of non-local exchange of modular variables. The opener exchange only modular energy with the photon, then because the modular energy of the opener might be completely uncertain. Why? Because we know that the opener must act only at a given range of time, because if it will act at longer range of time, then the whole condition will not be satisfied. So if we know that the opener wave function, its time evolution is restricted to a given region of time, that after that, if we translate it by more than this time, the wave function becomes orthogonal, then we know that the modular energy into the I, minus I, h t over h bar, for all t larger than this time, that modular energy must be zero, because that is exactly the condition that if I translate the wave function by a longer time than this, it becomes orthogonal. So the condition for this experiment is that the opener must have a whole range of modular energies that are zero. That's the condition that is, right? You understand? If I have, remember what I've shown to you. Remember what I did, for example, I've shown that if this is position, if the wave function of any quantum system is different from zero only in this range, then the average of e to the I p l prime, where l prime is bigger than this, is equal to zero, because it translated from here to here. So all the modular variables of this system, if I look at all the modular variables with l prime larger than a, they're all equal to zero. And the same thing will be true for time. If I look at the wave function is a function of time. The vector is a function of time. The condition is that this vector at time t times this vector at time 0 is equal to 0 for t larger than some t. I want this thing to be finished before this time, because otherwise it will not work. So that means again that the average of e to the I, the average of e to the minus I h t over h bar, which translates this one to that one, that must be equal to 0 for all t larger than this period t that we are talking about, because we want the whole thing to be finished before that period is over. So we have now a physical reason why the multiple variables for one system must be in a whole range equal to 0, and that opens the possibility that the other system probability distribution will change if we only change those modular variables. So now, something very interesting happens. That if we look what happened to our photon distribution, the probability for energy initially, if this is the probability as a function of the energy, was different from 0 only up to some rays, which is the infrared range. Because we said we superpose the photon only with infrared frequencies. Then we say that when the opener comes and opens that box and let the photon get out, we find suddenly that the mu distribution of the whole ensemble, if we repeat this experiment many times, most of the time the photon will be left in the box and probably some slightly low energy, and very rarely the photon will come out with very high energy. So we look now at the new distribution of the photon. The new distribution for the ensemble looks now like this. Here's the probability. The final probability distribution is still mostly different from 0 here, only here, and then far away here, there is a very, very small bump, which is a very small probability that the photon went out suddenly with ultraviolet frequency, right? And the point is that we have proven now that the difference between this distribution is this distribution is only the modular variable. If we calculate all the moments of the energy, they will be the same here and here. So just by exchanging the modular energy, this magic happens. And you can now understand intuitively why a modular variable is relevant here. Suppose we look at our wave function in position. Suppose now we do the same thing for charged particle. We can do the same thing. So we have a charged particle which has, in space, it has the following wave function. It's zero here. And it has very, very low changes. And at some region here, it has very small amplitude with much shorter wavelength than the rest. Now let me write the whole wave function. Let me write this wave function, psi of the electron, as the sum of two contributions, psi 1 of x plus psi 2 of x. Psi 1 of x is everything outside this region, and psi 2 of x is just this part, okay? I can write certainly the wave function as the sum of the two. Now, suppose that I now come suddenly with a flux, and bring it like this here, and that changes the phase of this compared to that. And the effect is just to change the phase. So if I change the phase of this from this plus that to this minus that, right, by changing the phase, just by changing modular variable, then I get a new psi of this, which is equal to psi 1 of x minus psi 2 of x, right? Now, if I subtract this from this, I get just 2 times psi 2 of x. Size surface obviously has high energy because now it's only different from zero there. So I see that if this doesn't have high energy, this must have high energy because the difference between them has high energy. So just by exchanging modular variables, I change the distribution from this one to this one because I now introduce, just by a change of phase, I introduce some suddenly a very high energy. So this shows again that if we look at interesting situation of collisions where only no local phenomena happen, only a change of modular variables, we can get this new situation where something very dramatic can happen, that we start with low energy and suddenly get out of the same system high energy. So now I claim that there seems to be a real problem with conservation law. Because although we have shown that for the whole ensemble of photons, all the moments remain the same, the average energy, all the moments remain the same, all the modulus change, nevertheless, there is something fundamentally different between the original thing and that new thing. In the new ensemble, we can find, by just measuring the energy, we can find sometimes very high energy that we could never find it before. So we have two distributions of energy. We were able to change from one to the other without giving any energy to the system because the open probability distribution did not change. And there is a fundamental difference between the two distributions. Even though the average of the energy is the same, the average of all the moments are the same, but I can find individual photons with energy that before I could never find it. So the question is, if I have two situations, one situation, there was no ultraviolet photon in the whole ensemble. I could measure the energy of all the photons. I will never find even one of them that is not infrared. And now I come and do something without paying any penalty because my distribution did not change at all. The thing that gave the opener did not change at all. Did not give me any energy. It only gave this mysterious modular energy that was completely uncertain for it. And after this happens, now I come to the same distribution, the same ensemble, and lo and behold, I find small part of it that has huge energy. It's true that if I look for the rest of the ensemble, I will find that all the photons that were left in the box, on the average, gain this energy that this one gained. But what happened
lost,
in this?
So if
I have many, many boxes, it's if for one box ultraviolet photon came, and all the other boxes that the photons were left there, that's not me now, right? Okay, so there is something very interesting that goes on with conservation laws, and I don't think I will tell you now the direction of solution. It's very, very interesting. I want you to think about it. Probably next week, when I give my series of talks, I will discuss it again, then I will tell you the ideas that we have about the solution. Are there any questions about this?
Yeah, can you just explain the connection to this argument?
What?
The connection to this argument. Okay. You argued that expectation value of the opener modular variable had to be zero for some range of moduli.
Okay. I first of all say that if I want to consider conservation law, it's much nicer to consider them not for the moment, but for the modular variable.
Yes.
So if I want to say that I want the probability of U1 plus E2 initially to be the probability of U1 plus E2 final, I want this to be equal because I want conservation law.
Yeah.
I can express this equality either by saying that I will take the average of the energy, we find the same average of the square, etc., at different moments. Or instead, I can say that I can analyze this by looking at the average of e to the I, e1 plus e2 over e0. Take this average. That means I take the Fourier transform of this thing. And if I look at all these things, it's the same as looking at the probability. Now, if the two systems are decoupled, then the average, the average of this, which is the product, is equal to the product of the average. Right? Therefore, I'm saying if the systems initially were not entangled, and if at the end they were not entangled, then the condition that the total energy is conserved implies that the average of e to the I e1 over e0 times the average of e to the I e2 over e0 remain the same. Now I want that one of them will change and the other will not change because I want, so that means that that thing must be zero for all the range when this changes, okay? So now I ask, what can I achieve? What changes in the distribution here I can achieve if I'm only allowed to change this range of modulo variable? I'm not...
Which range? So
the range where this is zero. I have a whole range of E0 for which this is zero. In fact, for all E0 smaller than something, this is zero. So I'm only allowed to change this distribution by changing that range. And I'm claiming now, that means that I'm allowed only to do an exchange of modulo energy, not an exchange of moment.
Yes.
And I've shown that if I do just a phase difference, if I introduce just a phase here, that doesn't change any of the moment, but by changing the relative sign between this and this, I've shown that suddenly this energy comes out. And that is an exchange of modulo variable. So I've seen, therefore, that when those two systems just exchange modulo variables, on this system I can't see because it's completely uncertain. So I'm only left with a change here. This did not change, and that change was enough to go from this original distribution to the distribution with this thing, because by changing the relative phase, suddenly this thing appears in distribution. Because in psi 1 plus psi 2, this wasn't there, it was only low frequency. But psi 1 minus psi 2 now must have this energy because the difference between the two is just this thing alone. So therefore, by just a change of modulo variable, change of phase, like AB effect, I was able to introduce a true dramatic change because very early I will suddenly find photons that all of them were infrared. Very rarely I would suddenly find an ultraviolet photon and have all the justification to ask where in this individual case, where the energy came from.
So just to clarify, the little bump here is at distance E0.
Hmm?
The little bump is at E0 in the
energy. No.
So what's the relationship between the location of the bump and E0?
No, it's not trivial. I have initially a probability of E as a function of E, which is different from zero only here. But that probability is made out of sum of infrared that has a free parameter there. The free parameter is the one, remember my magic formula with the alpha. That free parameter can tell me how a superposition of all these energies with very complicated amplitudes can give me, when I look at the, if I look at the same thing as a function, let's do it with momentum, it's easier to see. If I look at the probability of the momentum as a function of momentum, here, these are all very low momentum, right? Momentum corresponds to infrared photons. Now I look at the same problem in the positional representation. If I look at the same problem in a positional representation, I see that the Fourier transform of that distribution into position looks like this. I have this is only x. There is some region here where I see very, very short wavelengths. And the short wavelengths that I see here, that depends on the parameter alpha that I put here, what kind of superposition I get there. And then, later the wave function goes here, and I call this region psi 2 and this region psi 1, and I see that by changing the relative phase between psi 2 and psi 1, I suddenly change the energy from this low energy to this new energy, that is this energy that depends on this parameter alpha. But the condition to change it, independent of what the parameter alpha is just to say that I must interact here only in this region. So the region that the thing jump interacts, this is what I call P0. And once I say I must interact only in this region, that means that the wave function that interacts with it must its module momentum for all momentum higher than that, for all distance higher than that, must be equal to zero. So the P0 is not the difference between the energy here and here. It's the condition at what range of space I have the thing, the super oscillation there. So it's a little bit subtle. You have to.
So in other words, the little bump in energy will be, the energy of it will be related to the time for which the opener is open.
No, that's the energy.
No. The energy I can arrange by superposition of these frequencies. I can arrange this region to be as large as I like, and this thing to be as small as I like. And all of these are free by introducing more and more real situations. But the condition for the module is just that I have to interact in time enough, sufficient, fast enough that it will not come from here. And in space, I have to interact in this particular region. That's why the module momentum, module energy must be completely uncertain for the system that interacts with it. And I change only module variable. Look, it's a little bit such a mathematics. So you can't see all the details immediately. You need to do some homework. Some work at home. Yeah.
So for this to be true, it has to be that the
what?
For this to work, it has to be that the moments don't fix the distribution entirely.
That's right.
Can you give some insight into that? Like what kinds of features can you change without changing all the moments? It's just exactly the modular. That's what I was going to say.
Well, we have seen. There is always some normality that happens. The simplest example that we saw, if I have the superposition of two wave functions that are separated by distance L, and then I look at psi 1 plus psi 2 and psi 1 minus psi 2. These two wave functions have the same moment, but they have completely different module variables. So the minute you introduce some normality, you can get the situation. And the neuroticity comes here because we have to cut the time very definitely. We are not allowed to look at it at higher. So there is neuroticity at the beginning because I have to do something with very sharp or very sharp boundary. Okay? So it's a general situation that once you have non-analytic distributions, then you separate the moments from the module.
So another question is, have you thought about applications for this? I mean, like you could produce a laser gun or something that produces
there is a whole industry nowadays with having situations where you have weak values that are outside the range. This is a situation. I have a range of frequencies here, and I get some other frequency outside of it, right? So this whole wave function that I found, the super oscillation, was just by looking at which values that were outside the range, okay? Now, there's a whole industry nowadays that look at experiments where you do pre and post selection, get weak values that are out of the range. This is a new kind of amplification that allows you to see very weak signals because it's a very nice way to overcome all kinds of noises. And to overcome also the idea that if you have to, if you collect all, then possibly you will flood the instrument. So there are lots of interesting applications by learning to think about how to separate these new weak values from the usual ones, okay? So I think Jeff can give you a list now of many, many examples of laboratories in the world that are that doing this kind of thing. Not so extremely rarely like this, but in principle it's the same idea. Okay, so this is the business of an interesting connection between collision theory and exchange of modular variables that is quite surprising. Now, the other topic I want to consider is the idea how to solve the measurement problem with looking at quantum mechanics in this new way of two vectors. And nevertheless, how to keep the possibility of having free will that we would like all to keep with this future boundary collision. So I want to discuss both things together. So here's the idea. Suppose I have an experiment, a quantum experiment, where I have like in Stern-Gerlach, I have a particle that goes up or down depending on its spin, and then the particle, this is an atom, that I put it in homogeneous magnetic field that pushes the magnetic moment up if it has one value and down if it has the opposite value of the spin, because the Hamiltonian is equal to mu minus mu, the magnetic moment, times bz times sigma z, there is a magnetic field in the z direction, and if bz is simply proportional to z, then the Hamiltonian interaction Hamiltonian will be equal to minus mu times z times sigma z times some b0. So you see that the particle feels a constant force during the time of the interaction, and the constant force depends on the sign of the spin. If the spin is up, there is a force in one direction, the spin is down, a force in the opposite direction. So after a finite time, there is an impulse, the change of momentum, this is enough to overcome the uncertainty, and then we have a separation. The atom will go up if the magnetic moment spin was one, and down with the other. But that doesn't finish the experiment. The reason why we did this step was to try and correlate the spin with some other still microscopic variable, but that microscopic variable can be amplified easily. So once we separate the position here and here, now we can have a macroscopic object here, like counters or photographic plate, and because the positions are now separate, we can amplify it. And now we amplify it so that we have a macroscopic spot here from a single atom produces a macroscopic spot, either here or here, and now we can come and look at it and see what the spin was. So there are two steps, as von Neumann suggested, two steps in any quantum experiment. The first step is try to correlate the thing that we want to measure with some other microscopic observable, but that microscopic observable can be amplified. And then the second step is to amplify, and then finally we have a macroscopic recording, and we are in business. But now the trouble with this von Neumann measurement theory, as von Neumann immediately recognized, is that what happens if I start with superposition of spin up and spin down? That my formalism will lead me to a superposition, final superposition, of either of a macroscopic spot here and macroscopic spot there. And this atom is absorbed either here or here, or we can even arrange that the photon can still go out and produce the macroscopic spot. So we have a measurement we can do, if we want, we can do something that's called the negative experiment. If you want to keep the atom, still to do it another experiment, then the thing we can do, we can put only photographic plate here. And now, if the atom comes here, there is a big spot here. But if we see there is no big spot here, it means that the atom is going here. So it's an experiment that keeps the atom and nevertheless does the macroscopic recording. Okay, so for Lyman recognize there is a problem. The problem is we see we have here two spots, but we know that when we come and look at this photographic plate, we see only one spot. So this is the problem of how to solve this measurement problem. And there are a number of ways to do it. What von Neumann did was to say, look, once we come to the classical world, we know that there cannot be a macroscopic superposition of spot here or spot there, so I will make an axiom. The minute when that thing makes a meeting between the quantum domain and the classical domain, I will put an axiom. The classical domain wins, and we have a collapse to one of them according to the probabilities. We don't have to explain it. It comes simply because of the fact that classical things cannot be in superposition. So this must happen. I don't have to explain why it happens. He says, we know that we have a meeting ground between classical objects like us that can never be in superposition and microscopic objects that are in superposition. We know that the classical thing wins in this world, and then we can always go just to one of them with the correct probability. And I don't have to explain it, he said. It's an axiom that happened. But other people started to worry about it, to say, what does it mean classical? It's what, how many atoms do we need before we say that this is classical? As long as that, it can be very large, but still we have to consider it's made of atoms. So this, people say this is not a good idea. There must be some better way to think about it. Then what are the options? One option was the option of Bohm that says that there is we have quantum mechanics, not the whole story. In fact, there are all kinds of options that change quantum mechanics and others that don't change it. First of all, the one that doesn't change it is the most crazy one, of course. This is the many-world idea. The many-world idea says, believe quantum mechanics blindly. Believe what it tells you. So it tells you that you see both spots, you see both spots. Why not? The fact that you are not aware of it, okay, quantum mechanics can tell you why you are aware of it. Because if you are superposition of amplitudes, one amplitude doesn't know about the other. So don't worry that you don't know that you went to but believe the mathematics. That's what I call being slave to the mathematics. Because quantum, if you take this seriously, you say, my God, the mathematics tells me that I'm now at two different I am now at two different places. I'm talking to you now, and I'm talking to my friend in Israel, and I'm talking to Sandro in England. I'm already in all these places together. What does it mean? I don't believe it. Okay? I can't believe it. So and there is no way to check it. You know, if you come up with an idea of some explanation, there should be in principle a way to check it. Then I can prove, I believe, although I have not done it, but I believe I can do it, that in principle there is some size of object, of number of atoms. Certainly I include in my body 10 to the 27, 8, something like that, atoms. Also, I'm all the time in interaction with the environment. So my quantum state is not just a state of these atoms, which are all very entangled, but it's also entangled with the rest of the universe. In order to make, to see that I can interfere my state being here, well, my state being in Israel right now, right, I have to be able to change the state of all the of my atoms here to the state of my atoms there. There is no way to do it, because if you try to find out what are the kind of fields microscopic fields, you have measuring devices you have to do in order to do that, I am sure that I can show that you will run into two problems. First of all, you will need to use more than all the atoms in the world to have enough macroscopic objects. And second, if you try to do this concentration, you will run into black hole much before that. So I think it's possible, and maybe I will do this challenge, it's possible to show that there is never, in principle, a way to check that we are that microscopic objects can be in a superposition. If it cannot be checked, then we say, OK, we believe the mathematics, although we will never be able to check it. That is a very bad approach to physics, because we always thought in physics that we have, if we have a theory, we should be able to falsify it by experiment. That's a condition to have a good physical theory. This, many ways, doesn't satisfy this condition. OK, so suppose we don't accept this as a solution to the problem. Then we have to look at what kind of changes in the theory we have to make in order to get this going from S2 spots to 1 with as minimal change as possible in quantum theory. So there were a number of attempts. One attempt is the attempt of Bohm to say that actually he adds to the usual description, he has an extra hidden variable, like you have a wave function for electron, it has also some, inside this range, it has some point, which is telling you, if you make a measurement, where you will find the electron. And he showed, that was a very big surprise at first, because von Neumann saw that he could give a proof that there cannot be such a theory. But Bohm found a mistake in von Neumann, and so that indeed it's possible to say that there is a single point there that interacts with the wave in a new way, but the motion of this point will be definite, and it will give exactly the probabilities of quantum mechanics as long as you just think of a single particle. But the minute when you think of more than a single particle and the particles are entangled, then that point is not in three dimensions, but it's in 3n dimensions. So it's becoming very, very complicated to understand what it means, because one aspect of it is that you can show that because it's a point moving locally in 6 dimensions for 2 particles, actually it behaves non-locally in ordinary space, because part of it is here and part of it is there. And indeed, what Bellman has proven is that if you accept this kind of idea, you must run into non-local interactions between those hidden variables, and then it again becomes a problem, because if we want to say that every theory has to be, yeah, you can check it, then what Bohm agreed that you should be able to check it, so he believed that indeed there will be in the future some way to really check that those hidden variables exist. But then Bell has proven that if at some time in the future you will be really able to show these points, then you will be able to transfer to send information faster than light. So either you accept the idea that relativity must be safe forever, and causality couldn't be broken, or you have to say that Bohm is predicting that perhaps sometime in the future you will have situations where you could see that causality is broken. So I think that my own taste is telling me that I don't like the theory of Bohm, not because of this causality, but because of this very strange situation here where you have a particle and a wave. The wave affects the particle, but the particle doesn't affect the wave. The equation motion of the wave doesn't know anything about the particle. So we have this mysterious situation that is against the whole idea of action and reaction. If we look at we have the point is affected by the wave function. Yes? But the wave function equation of motion doesn't know about the point. So there's something, I feel in my bones that that's not the right approach. And by the way, I tell you that when I started to interact with Bohm, we had an agreement. I told him that I would like, at least in the beginning of the career, to do only things that are in everyday physics and not anticipate some future physics. So we never discussed hidden variables apart from the one time when Bohm suggested that we should check the experiment of C.S. Wu to see if indeed there the correlation between the two photons that were emitted when a positronium was annihilated, where that correlation can be explained classically or you must use EPR kind of condition. And that discussion, which is one part of my thesis, has shown that indeed there is no way to explain the result of C.S. Wu experiment by using classical models, and that, I think that was before Bell and before Aspect experiment. It's true that there in this experiment we did not analyze all possible classical explanations. We just analyzed the most obvious one. So in that sense, we did not, but this experiment did not show that for sure there is no classical explanation. But Bohm was very unhappy because he was hoping that maybe his hidden variable will win and we will see that something, at this condition, something is not true quantum mechanically. But he was very honest. The minute I did a calculation and we show a calculation, it was by the way not a trivial thing, theoretical calculation. But I was able to do it, and then he accepted it, that there is no way to avoid the possibility that the hidden variables interact non-locally. So this is another attempt, and there is a third attempt, so a number of attempts that are all very ugly. All the other attempts are doing all kinds of artificial modification of quantum mechanics. One is the thing that's called the GRW. And yeah, Gerardi, I don't remember. Yeah. What they say is, if you have a wave function describing a quantum particle, very rarely, suddenly some mysterious knocking happens, this wave function suddenly collapses. But it's so rarely that if you do it on each individual electron, you will never see it. But if you have 10 to 24 electrons, like in a macroscopic object, one of them can be knocked. And that's enough to collapse the whole wave function, because it's a superposition of product here and a product there. So even if you just collapse one of them, it collapses the whole thing, okay? So in that sense, it's nice. But if you look at the way that it's done, as a mathematical theory, every attempt to do it in a nice way doesn't work. So I think that can be ruled out also. Then there are all kinds of attempts to introduce changes in Schrödinger equation from linear equation to equations which will be non-linear in the wave function. And then you can easily arrange that there will be collapses. But again, all such attempts, I think, even Weinberg did some attempts like that, and you can show that all of this will lead to some kind of difficulty with relativity or something else. So we are left only with one possibility, which is very, very natural, and that is the possibility I suggest. What is the possibility? I'm saying, look, we have found that if we take a quantum system and do a pre-selection region and a post-selection, then we can discuss in the middle the system with two vectors, and it's so beautiful, and we get all kinds of nice new things from this. So if this is natural, we do the pre and post-selection, why not consider the whole wave function of the universe as a quantum system? And in this quantum system, we are allowed to assume that we have two boundary conditions. Not we. I mean, nature has two boundary conditions. One that comes from the past that tells you what was the initial wave function, and another comes back from the future, which tells you so to say, what would be the final wave function, it will be the same as the time evolution of the initial one. That's why there is something new. And then the question is to show a number of things. A, that if you assume that, you don't get any prediction that will contradict experiments that are done now. So the first attempt is to show that I can choose this future boundary condition in such a way that it will get the usual probabilities, but nevertheless it will take care of this macroscopic thing not being a superposition. And I claim that I can do that. And the rest of the story will be after intermission. Okay? Okay. Okay. So suppose question. Yes.
So in the two-state formalism,
yeah.
Should I think of the future as teaching us about the past or causally influencing the past?
Wait with this question for half an hour and then ask it if you still want to ask it, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm going to tell you exactly an answer to that question. I mean, the main problem seems to be if the future comes back and tells the measuring device what to do, that means that it's already now known what will happen, and therefore we seem to be a violation of free will, because I can decide freely something, but the future already tells me what's going to happen. So this comes to the famous problem that, you know, that religious people and philosophers wonder from the beginning of time, what does it mean that all is foreseen and permission is given? The idea, for example, for religious people was God knows the future. And therefore, if God knows the future, what kind of freedom we do have? Why does it punish us for for something that we don't have any, he knows already what we are going to do, so what's the point of punishing us? So this is the problem of, permission is given, free will is given, but all is foreseen. So how can the two things live together? And by the way, there is a nice story about that issue, whether free will is an illusion or not. There is the following story. There is a guy that is in front of a judge, and the judge asks him, well, do you admit that you were responsible for killing that, murdering this guy? He said, yes, I do. So the judge asked him, before I pass the punishment that you get, do you have something to say? He said, yes, Your Honor, you are an educated person, and you know that Newton has taught us that we are made of atoms, and the atoms are deciding exactly what I'm going to do. So why should I be punished for something that I have absolutely no freedom on doing something else? And the judge gets confused for a minute, but then suddenly smiles and says, yes, but I'm also made of atoms, and my atom decays for me. So the whole business of free will may be an illusion, but nevertheless, I for myself, and I think hopefully many of you, feel that there is something more to it than just an illusion. And there is a meaning for responsibility, etc. So we want to see if our physics will leave us room for that kind of meaningful freedom. Okay, so what's the idea anyhow? The idea is the following. We know that if we have a microscopic particle and we say this particle coming from the past has sigma is equal to plus one because that's how the universe started. Suppose this particle existed from the beginning of the universe and it started, the wave function of the whole universe dictated that when it comes from the past, it has at the present a sigma is equal to plus one. Suppose I want to say on this particle that also the future boundary condition of the universe sends back information that says that now from the past, this microscopic particle has sigma e equal to plus 1. From the future, this microscopic particle has sigma y equal to plus 1. And that will be a two-vector formulation for a given microscopic particle. But immediately we see that that's inconsistent. Because if at any time here we come and do an experiment on this particle, we destroy the thing that comes from the future. And this cannot be a true story if we are free to do any experiment that we like at any time. Then we can't say a microscopic object will have two boundary conditions. But I want to prove now that a macroscopic object can have two boundary conditions, and it's safe against all kinds of experiments that we can do on this macroscopic object. So let me tell you what is the interesting new insight.
Sorry, Yadio.
Yes?
May I confirm the terminology of the macroscopic object?
Yeah.
In the microscopic object, for example, such as the single atom, such as the few atoms, itself might be sort of considering about the macroscopic object. But you think it's a macroscopic object, what does it mean?
Okay, there is always a question.
Yeah.
At what place, at what time, quantitative thing becomes qualitative thing. We know, for example, in classical physics, we know that we have in classical physics, when we have many, many particles, system with many particles, we know that such systems can make phase transition. And this is a very dramatic thing. On the other hand, you say, what does it mean? If you have any finite number of particles, you cannot show that they undergo a phase transition. Or the whole idea of thermodynamics, it survives only, truly irreversible things can happen only if you have system with infinite number of particles. As long as the system has finite number of particles, independent of how large it is, you can't prove the laws of thermodynamics, or the second law, for example. But we feel that at some point, there is a qualitative thing that happens because of large quantities. We say that if we have a system that has 10 to the 24 particles, then the probability that this system suddenly, due to the fluctuation in the whole table, could suddenly fail, which is certainly an exponentially small probability, but we know we will never see. It will never happen because the probability of being of something to 2 to the order of 10 to the 24, 1/2. In order for all the atoms to be at the same time making the table down, the probability for this to happen is 1/2 to the power of the number of particles, because these particles can have either momentum up or down. So we say 1/2 to the 10 to the 24 is such a small number that we would like to replace by 0, okay? So we always accept the idea that there is some mysterious thing that's called probability that can be defined only if you have infinite system, and nevertheless we know that that probability works even if we have finite system if the number is sufficiently large. So it's only with this thing I will discuss the difference between what I call macroscopic system and micro. When the number it becoming the probability of getting something different from what I predict becomes so exponentially small that we will never see it, then we say that's equivalent to saying that that system is macroscopic. You will see the quantitative thing more definitely later. Now, suppose I want to say the following thing. I have a quantum particle and the macroscopic system. I will take a very simple macroscopic system just to show the idea. The macroscopic system will be a cavity with 10 to the 24 atoms in it. And I have now a superposition of the microscopic particle being up, then at the present all the atoms are concentrated on this side. And if the spin is down, all the atoms are on this side. So this may be like two different macroscopic spots. I have a situation where I have an entanglement. If the spin is up, that macroscopic system has all the atoms on this side, initially. If the spin is down, they have all of them on this side, and then, of course, in time, they become completely mixed up, okay? So this is like the two macroscopic spots. And the question is now, there is no partition here, so I know that if all of them start here, and they collide, etc., after a very short time, all memory will be lost, effectively, because they will be spread completely in the box, independently if they started here or here. And nevertheless, we say, if the box is completely filled, we can have, there is still a unitary transformation that makes the state that started here always to be orthogonal from the state that started here. That orthogonality remains. Of course, it's extremely complicated to do a measurement to distinguish it. But we can say, suppose we make an assumption that independent of how complicated it is, the future boundary condition for this macroscopic system is such that when you take it back in time, it will make all the particles go here. After all, it's a unitary transformation. Very, very complicated final condition, but we assume that nature has this final boundary condition. The question is now whether this thing is stable against disturbances from some measurements of some of these particles here. This is the interesting question. You know, so that if I try to...
Sorry, the future state is not going to be a microscope.
Sorry?
The future state is...
The future state is a state... The future state is a state of the same number of particles, very, very complicated state, yeah. All of them are entangled. But such that when you go back in time, from the final time to this present, there will be one state that will make all the parts coalesce here, and there is another orthogonal state, as the future boundary conditions, will make at the present all of them be here. This is consistent. Nobody in the right mind will be able to prepare it by himself, but God can do whatever he likes. Or the boundary condition of the universe can be whatever we like, although later we'll describe it differently. But the question is, I'm going here from this future boundary condition in direction where the entropy is increasing. This is a very, very unstable boundary condition. I have a boundary condition here. The question is, suppose I take this boundary condition, and suppose at some time, some intermediate time here, I come and make a measurement on one or a few of these atoms, and do other collapses on them. Wouldn't that completely destroy the prediction or the recognition that I will still come here? Now, we know the following thing. We know that if we have a system of atoms that are now spread all around, if I reverse all the classically, reverse all the velocities, they will all go to the corner if that's how they started. But I know that even if I change just one atom, remove one atom, or put one extra atom, that thing will not happen, because very quickly, since I'm trying to predict by changing time to minus t, I'm trying to predict from the future boundary condition a direction of motion in which the entropy keeps decreasing, right? When I change the relative velocity from plus to minus, the system now goes from high energy, high entropy, to low entropy. That thing, that motion, is extremely unstable. Because the minute when I make a disturbance, even a few atoms, then it will be like a snow, you know, from the mountain. How do you call it when the snow
avalanche?
Because suppose I just change one particle. There are many, many collisions. After a very short time, this particle collides with another one. Now, two particles will go wrong. Then the two are making four, four are making eight. So very quickly, the whole thing, the whole idea, the whole arrangement, very careful arrangement, they will all collapse to the corner, doesn't work anymore. So don't we have the same problem when we say that the future boundary condition tries to tell us, going back, whether the atoms where there was this macroscopic spot or this macroscopic spot, I'm allowed still to go to this box at some time, some future time, and make some experiment to measure the state of some particles there. I'm not free to put an Hamiltonian definition because that will be just the condition of the unitary evolution. But if I do an extra collapse, then that seems to be able to destroy that connection. And now there is something very interesting that people did not realize. For example, a former student of mine, David Albert, he was a postdoc with me, wrote a whole book saying that he believed that just based on the idea that you have collapses in quantum mechanics, you can show that you introduce necessarily time irreversibility. Because, he said, if you start, everybody knows, I start with sigma x equal to plus 1, then I make a measurement of sigma z and find the sigma z equal to plus 1. I try to go from the future back to the past. I cannot tell whether it came from sigma x equal to plus 1 or sigma x equal to minus 1. That memory is erased by the collapse. Not in the manual, but if we believe in collapse, then it seems to be that collapse necessarily introduce a breakdown in time reversibility, right? But I want to show now that that is not true if you have a macroscopic system. And that's very interesting.
Thank you. I have a question.
Huh?
I have a question.
Yes.
Is the way that the observer is not rotating in the system? System itself is that now is composed of the atom, but the now is that you want to measure this microscopic system. Then the you mean that some observer.
No, I want to say that I want to introduce collapses. Effective collapses.
Yeah.
So I first introduce the first effective collapses by this system going to this macroscopic state or that macroscopic state. Then if at any time I come and make a measurement with another instrument of one of these atoms, with another instrument, then that other instrument will also go to macroscopic state this way or that way, but one of them will disturb the other if I try to go back in time. I want to show that that doesn't happen. Not to think about it.
Yeah.
All right, so very interesting observation. If I have any vector psi and I make a measurement of any operator A, then I know that I collapse psi, if I believe in collapse, I collapse psi to one of the eigenvectors of A, right? But it's very important to realize that any eigenvector of A has still non-zero overlap with this original psi. Because if I can write psi always as a sum of A n, psi n, where these are eigenstates of this operator A, when I make a measurement, I go from this to one of those. But definitely the scalar product between this and the new one is not zero. If I take a state, if I take one of the atoms here and change it to orthogonal state, then this trouble will happen. But if I do a measurement on it, and suppose this atom now is spread everywhere, it's entangled, I make a measurement and collapse it to this state. That measurement seems to change it completely, but no. The scalar product of the new state for this atom and the scalar product of the whole system before is not equal to zero. It can be a small number, but not zero. This is extremely important. Now, because it's not zero, then I can show that suppose the amplitude, after I do this extra collapse, the amplitude to be in the original state is 1/1,000,000, for example, because there are, say, 1,000,000 possible outcomes. So I now come with the new future boundary condition modified by that thing. So when it's modified by this experiment on one of the atoms, then there is an amplitude of 1/1,000,000 that is still the original vector, and therefore it will go to this thing. And there is a probability of 1 - 1/1,000,000 that it will be a new state, but this new state will not collapse either to this or that. It will go to the whole box. And therefore, the scalar product of the state that violates the time reversibility is its scalar product with both of the original states is exponentially 1/10^(10^9) small, while the thing that still survives will have a finite 1/1,000, 1/1,000,000 probability. So I claim that if you have a sufficiently large macroscopic system that you can inject the probability of 1/10^24, like you just suggesting, then this future boundary condition will survive when it goes back in time. I suggest you to think about it. It's not a trivial idea, but it's also written, this idea is written in articles. One is by Gross, me and Gross, and
Nelly
Cohen, yeah. So if you are interested more, you should read it. This shows that there is a new protection for time reversibility when you have sufficiently large macroscopic system, then it can survive all collapses that you can do, finite number of collapses you can do in the future. It doesn't disturb the time reversibility, contrary to microscopic objects. Now comes the issue, if indeed I say that the outcome of this experiment, when I made the experiment of the Sarah-Gerlach experiment, and I got on the photographic plate, I got a microscopic spot here or a microscopic spot there, then I said there is a future boundary condition that tells me already now that this must come to be this way. So the future seems to know already what's going to happen. So what about freedom? The freedom that I have, which was recognized by Bell, Bell invented the idea of Biabel. There is a freedom. The freedom is, I know from the future that we'll have this microscopic bulb. But what is the meaning of it? For example, I could use the magnet pointing in one direction, then going, having this blob means that the spin goes up. But I could do instead a different experiment where I use the magnet, the reverse magnet. I will still get the same blob, but the meaning will be now that the spin is not up but down because the reverse magnetic field. And I can use different experiments that all of them will end up in the same blob here, but the meaning of the experiment is different. And that's my freedom. I can decide the future determines there will be a macroscopic blob up in this macroscopic system. But the question whether this macroscopic thing, to what it is connected in the microscopic world, depends which experiment I've used to come to that thing. And I'm free to decide which experiments I want to do, independent of the fact that the future already knows that they will have this macroscopic system. So this is a way how free will can survive the idea that every macroscopic system has only one definite state, and nevertheless the connection between the micro and the macro depends on which interaction I use to make these connections, and I'm free to choose any interaction that I like, and because that future boundary condition doesn't dictate which interaction I use in the measuring devices. So free will can survive the fact that macroscopic systems are always only in one state. So I would like now to say the following. I first want to invent a terminology, which is the following. Remember when I did the ABL formalism, when we discussed it, we have shown that if I have a state psi 1 here, and a state psi 2, a final state psi 2 here, and I send it back here and here, then if I want to calculate the result of any experiment in the middle, for example, the probability of getting any eigen value of some measurement, remember it was the calculation was psi 1 times u from the original time t1 to t, times the particular answer I got, it is the eigenvector of the thing that I measured. And then I wrote in A1, and then I wrote here mu dagger of T2T times the state psi. So so I say that I use an equal footing, this vector that comes back from the future, T2, and this vector that comes from the past. Now I want to make still one more modification. I can, what is u dagger of T2T? This is equal to e to the I of h bar h times T2 minus T, right? But I can rewrite this as e to the I, or minus I, sorry. I can rewrite this as e to the minus I, or no, I have to write I because it's u dagger. So I can write it as e to the I over h bar times h of t2 minus t1 times e to the minus I over h bar e to the h times t minus t1, right? You see? Because the t1 will cancel here, and this will be just... Okay. So that means that I can say the following. I can use now two vectors at the beginning, the vector psi 1, and another vector, psi 2, this vector is such that if I use the usual Hamiltonian, it will end up in the final state. That is the meaning of this thing. This thing, x from psi 2, will be exactly this. So I'm simply now saying that I can use the vector psi 1 and the vector psi 2 that by the usual Hamiltonian will come to the final state. I can use both of them coming from the past. And I call this history vector, and I call this destiny vector. Yeah. So I can say that if I discuss a macroscopic system or a classical system, the classicality is automatically ensured because I have not only the initial state of this macroscopic system, but it has also a destiny that tells you exactly at which, when it comes, when it interacts with the microscopic system, you want to go to two infant states, this destiny state tells you to which one it will go. And I'm allowed to do it because I know that the future boundary condition coming back will be safe, and therefore I can use it like this. So I will say now that the difference between microsystems and quantum systems and classical systems is that microsystems have only history vector and vector coming from the future, but I'm not allowed to call it a destiny vector because it's unstable. But the classical system or macroscopic system that I want to protect its classicality is to say that if the system is large enough, and this is a question of when the quantity becomes quality, but if it's large enough, and we are, for example, large enough, then each time such a macrosystem comes in interaction with a microsystem that will make it go to two different macrostates, then there is already a destiny vector that assures that only one of them will be there. So this is the way that I want to introduce a modification of quantum mechanics that will now ensure that there are indeed two regimes, the quantum regime and the classical regime, and they live together because of that a new kind of two-vector formulation. Okay, I think that that's a good spot to end our sessions. I will summarize by saying that if we start with the basic new idea of the difference between classical and quantum mechanics being that there is a difference in the dynamics, that the classical dynamics which is Poisson bracket, is local as the quantum dynamics, which is commutator, has non-local features to it. The minute when you say that it has non-local features to it, we immediately come to the realization that there must be uncertainty. Because if there are no uncertainties, any non-locality will immediately violate causality. So the only way that we can have non-locality, like module, effect of module values, etc., it must come together with some protection, and that protection is uncertainty. So we deduce the uncertainty from the non-locality. Once we have uncertainty, then we know we can put two boundary conditions, because uncertainty means that the future is not dictated by the past. So we come to the idea that the description of quantum mechanics by two vectors. And I say that we can this way go all the way with the new story that all starts with one statement, one axiom. Contrary to the usual way when quantum mechanics is introduced is by all kinds of negative statements. Why? One, there are uncertainties, no reason at all why. Two, there is a description by wave. Nobody understands what this wave means, really. So from the beginning, we are in a situation where there is no hope to develop a story that will be free of mathematics. And I suggest that I have tried to show to you how I believe that such a story can be done. Thank you very much. Yeah.